But then the ultimate goal is to make your fundamentals sound impeccable, incredible, in all ranges, at all speeds, at all dynamics. And then you transfer that directly. There's a direct correlation from what you're doing in your technique to how you make music. Because in the end of the day, what we're actually doing is making music.
This episode contains adult language and adult humor.
Since when have trumpet players ever been considered adults?
If you are easily offended by these types of conversations, consider switching to the oboe. Welcome to the Trumpet Gurus Hang podcast. I'm your host, Jose Johnson. My guest for this episode is Paul Merkello. Now, Paul, he's a bit of a multitasker. In addition to his duties as the principal trumpet of the Orchestre Symphonique de Montreal, Paul is also a highly sought-after soloist. He's traveled the world performing both old and new works and recently completed his fifth solo recording project. And in his spare time, Paul is on the faculty of two universities, McGill University in Montreal and the Music Academy of the West in Santa Barbara, all in a day's work. So, pour yourself a big glass, pull up a chair, and let the hang begin! All right, and here we are, another phenomenal episode of the Trumpet Gurus Hang, and I'm here today with Mr. Paul Merkello. Paul, it is a pleasure to meet you, my good man.
Pleasure to meet you as well. Happy to be here.
Awesome. You know, before we go in any deeper into this, we'll just kind of use this as our jumping off point. I understand that you went to school with someone that I am very well acquainted with, Joey Tartel.
Yes.
So what I want to know, I want the dirt on Joey. Was Joey as big of a Joey in his college days as he is now, or did he just kind of grow into this persona?
No, bigger. He was bigger. He was a bigger Joey. I mean, I just saw him at ITG in San Antonio, and like, he cut his hair and he was all dressed up, and I almost didn't recognize him. But listen, I was as shocked as you are. At Eastman, in the middle of winter, this is not an exaggeration, he would wear huge baggy shorts. I think they were from North Carolina, UNC. Shorts and a t-shirt, and then he'd throw on a winter jacket, and he had long hair, much longer hair, and he was very how can I say it, I mean, he is a larger than life personality. I loved him. I loved seeing him and hanging out with him, because you know, he was more in the jazz arena, so we didn't cross paths as much. But a lot of times I'd catch him like at the end of the night when the school was closing, and all of us nerds who would practice until, you know, whatever, 11:05 p.m. would get on the bus. And that's when I would see him get on the bus in his shorts. And I would just laugh. I was just like, he would make me laugh, you know, which I was probably way too intense, way too serious at that time. So he definitely lightened the mood a little bit.
Yeah. Well, Joey's a great guy. And I didn't even realize, and I had him on the show a few episodes ago, and he did mention your name did come up in the conversation. I was like, oh, well, I'll have to ask about that. So,
well, I'm a huge fan. I mean, he's an incredible, incredible player. And you know, for whatever I'm talking about, like him wearing shorts and whatever, I don't take lightly how serious of a player he is. You know, he is one of the best or the best that's ever done it. So, you know, it was really a pleasure to be with him at Eastman to hear his work.
Yeah, he's a good guy. But let's get the conversation back on you. You're originally from the Chicagoland area, is that correct?
Well, yeah, I was born in Champaign, Illinois, and that's about 2 hours south, well, 2.5 hours south of Chicago. That's where the University of Illinois is located.
Yeah. So being in Montreal is not that quite of a stretch in terms of weather for you.
Well, I mean, being in Montreal now, I mean, if I compare our winters to Chicago, Illinois winters, it makes it look like kids play over there, because we in Chicago, or even in Champaign, which is further south, we would have winter coming around, you know, Christmas time is when we would get snow. And it would get really cold until about March. And then in March, unless you were by the lake in downtown Chicago, March started to have glimpses of spring. Now, just to give you some perspective, in Montreal, in March is when we're sometimes getting our absolute worst snowstorms, freezing cold temperatures. I call it Snowmageddon because it's like there's so much snow. It's like a battle. It's a battle to like dig your car out of the snow. And so Montreal winters can go to the end of April. And I'm not really exaggerating. Like it's nuts.
Yeah. I have never been to Montreal. I've been to Toronto. I've been to Vancouver quite a bit. Montreal is on my to-do list, but I think I just got to hit that right window because I am not a cold weather guy. So I want to make sure that I'm any place where when it's moderate temperatures.
Okay, you got to come visit. I'll tell you the best times are like right now. September in Montreal is one of my favorite months of the year because, well, today is just a little bit colder than usual, but it's around, let's see, we're in Celsius. So it's around like 23 to 28 degrees Celsius, which is around roughly 75 degrees Fahrenheit. And then at night it dips down to the 60s. So it's a little cooler. You sleep well at night. Fall in October here, when the leaves are changing, is absolutely epic. It's just gorgeous. So I really would recommend September, October.
All right. Well, I will make sure to add that to my travel itinerary now that travel has been opened up. So yeah, it's not that bad of a drive from central Pennsylvania. So I think I can handle that.
Come on over. Let me know when you're coming over, and I'll get you some tickets to the orchestra.
Oh, awesome! That would be fantastic. My wife would love that. She's been bugging me to go to the orchestra for a while. So. But speaking of the orchestra, I mean, your career path has taken you from Chicago to New York, your studies at Eastman. You've kind of bounced around to a few different places on your career path until you've landed in Montreal. How long have you been in Montreal?
Well, this is now I'm entering my 27th season with the orchestra.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
That's nice run.
The time has flown. It's just flown.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you see the path, or I don't want to say the path, but the current state of the classical music world, especially the orchestral world, in terms of being a viable job market? Because I know that for a while there were so many orchestras that were basically shutting down because they didn't have funding, which means that if you're going to school to be a principal trumpet player, your job market is just shrinking. How is that now? Is it stabilized? Has it grown? Is it continuing to diminish?
Well, I mean, it's a viable question, and it's one that it's been on the topic for forever. I mean, my entire professional career, I was always told, hey, there's not going to be the job market. Orchestras are suffering, which is true. I mean, many orchestras are having a very difficult time. That being said, it's really important, and I want to be meticulous in the way that I answer this, but it's really important that the major cities, let's just talk about North America, okay? The major cities, they have to be leaders in the arts and in culture. That means that governments need to be funding them, and the private sector, the companies that are very successful, and the private individuals that are very successful. I think it's an obligation. Well, I shouldn't say obligation. It's a responsibility to maintain the cultural standard of those cities. That being said, it's never really changed in the big cities in terms of the support. All the big orchestras are still doing very well. Then you have like certain tiers below that where some of the smaller cities, maybe it's not as successful. The funding is not as vast. And so they've gone through some crisis moments, but in many cases they bounce back. I mean, I'll just give you an example. I started my career when I was 22 in New Orleans with the New Orleans Symphony. It was called the New Orleans Symphony at that time. And after my first year as principal trumpet, I got a letter of termination, all of us did, from the New Orleans Symphony, stating that we were all no longer employees because the orchestra was filing for bankruptcy. And, you know, here we go. This is a prime example of what you're talking about. And I wasn't even done with Eastman. I was still in my senior year at that point. So I was kind of freaking out. And then the New World Symphony Orchestra had an opening. So I auditioned there and I got in, thank God. So I had a safe haven. But within 6 months, the orchestra in New Orleans reorganized as a cooperative called the Louisiana Philharmonic. And we came back. We were earning $50 a week at the beginning. All of us, even principals, $50 a week. Can you imagine? Like, you can barely live on that. And then that got to 100, then 150. And then it kept going and going and going until we could get enough community support to make it a viable job. Now, I personally couldn't afford to live off of $50 a week, so I stayed in Miami. And I commuted back and forth. It wasn't a long flight. And I was able to play the big concerts in New Orleans, but then also have my position in Miami. And eventually, and to this day, the Louisiana Philharmonic has been, you know, maybe not incredibly prosperous, but they're surviving and they're still going. So, wow, that, maybe that's a long way of answering it. I just want to be a half, glass is half full instead of half empty. Don't give up. If you're a student in school right now, don't give up on your dream. If that's your dream, there are orchestras, there are positions. There will be a place. If you have the talent and the hard work and the discipline to persevere, and you have something unique in your playing, there will be possibilities for you somewhere. You just have to keep going and never give up.
Yeah. Well, in the classical world, I mean, I know I am more, I have more experience in the commercial trumpet world, and you know the days of playing in a band or you know having a gig have changed. You know, so I mean there are certainly those people who do land those great cush gigs, but for most of us it's you know piecemeal. You know, you putting your career together piecemeal. Is that true in the classical world as well? Where, I mean, like when you're talking about playing in Miami and playing in New Orleans at the same time, basically, that's very similar to being like a, you know, a journeyman or, you know, kind of a freelancer. Is that part of the working world of the classical musician as well?
Well, this was a unique situation to me at that time, because like I said, I had so much student loan debt. There was no way that I could tell Louisiana, New Orleans, hey, I'm coming back to Louisiana Philharmonic for $50 a week. Like, I can't pay my bills. I couldn't do it.
Right.
So I'll stay here in Miami. If you want to find another first trumpet, that's fine. But I'd like to help you as much as I can. So they were open at that point, maybe even a bit desperate just to have me there and then just have somebody in that chair playing to get them started. So I said, listen, I'll pay for my ticket. And as long as I have, you know, somebody, I had a roommate in New Orleans, I didn't have to pay rent. I had a rent-free place in Miami. This is a unique situation, Jose, because it was a dire situation. Normally, when you win a job in an orchestra, that's your job. That's a full-time position where you're staying in one city. It shouldn't necessarily be vital for you to be bouncing around to different cities. However, in the freelance scene, you're absolutely right. If you don't win a job, a position in an orchestra that has a full-time contract, well, you're kind of at the mercy of wherever the gigs are. And that will make you what I would call a regional journeyman or journeywoman. You know, I mean, you've got to be able to have a good set of wheels and get yourself from gig to gig in that region. You know what I mean? Like, and that's a tough situation. I have many students who have gone through that situation, and you know, I always talk to them to make sure that, you know, is this what you really want? Are you happy being a freelancer, or would you rather have a full-time position? And most of them are working for the full-time position, but some of them actually do like the variety, and they don't want to be stuck. I say stuck. They don't want to be locked in to an orchestra. So they kind of are, some of them are going for that freelance situation. You know, a city like New York or LA can be very prosperous for that. be it Broadway versus the soundtrack scene in LA. You know, it could be very, very prosperous. In fact, in some ways, it could be as much or more than some symphony orchestras. So it really depends on what you're after.
Right, right. So it, yeah, in your situation, being being a principal, you've got that gig, but you're also, you know, you're also touring and being a featured soloist. So you know, when you're having to shift gears from being, you know, the guy in the back of the orchestra to being the guy in the front of the orchestra, you know, how do you manage you know, the mindset shift that you have to have between being you know, because being the principal, yes, you are the lead voice in the brass section, but still there's a big difference, I think, between being that guy and being the guy out front. So how do you manage the mind shift that you have to take to be able to be in both of those worlds and to do those to the level that you're able to do that at?
Well, you know, it's really difficult. It's really difficult. And I, you know, just recently I've been reflecting a lot on, you know, why I do this. Cause it's, you know, like we just finished, a tour in Asia with Mahler 5, and then we recorded it. We performed it, recorded it back here in Montreal. This was just a couple weeks ago. And now we're opening our season next week with Mahler 2, and then we're going on a European tour. And at the same time, I have, 4 concerto performances I have to get ready for, that are all happening within the next, whatever, 4 months. And like, I just got off, you could probably see the ring on my lip. I just got out of my studio before this interview and was practicing one of these brand new concertos that I'm working on. And it's so difficult. It's so challenging. And then I have to prepare Mahler 2 at the same time. And I'm just like, I think my head's going to explode right now. It's really, you know, like I said about your choice as a student of what you want to do. When I was a kid growing up, I didn't dream of playing in the orchestra. I dreamt of being a soloist. My first recording was Timofey Dokshitsu, because my family background's Ukrainian. I got a album only because I saw that he was born in Ukraine. Timofey Dokshitsu was born in Ukraine. And I bought his album of Haydn Hummel on the B-flat trumpet. And I absolutely wore that record out. And I just grew up wanting to sound like him and wanting to play like him because of our Ukrainian heritage. And then I heard Wynton Marsalis, you know, I heard Wynton playing, and I was like, I heard him do also Haydn Hummel, which he won the Grammy for. And I watched him on TV at the Grammys playing. And then I got all his subsequent recordings. And of course I grew up hearing Maurice André and Håkon Hardenberger, Tom Stevens, Gerard Schwartz, a number of other soloists that's what I wanted to do. And then as I got older, I realized, I shouldn't say this. I heard the Chicago Symphony come through my hometown and play Mahler 5. And I heard Herseth play the Mahler 5 live when I was probably 14 years old, 15. And that completely rocked my world. So I've always had this duality in my mind. You know, people ask me a lot, hey, why are you doing all these solos when you have a full-time gig at the orchestra? Why are you doing it? How do you do it? Whatever. If I'm to be true to myself as to what I want to be as a trumpet artist, I have to be true to why I started playing in the first place. And that's because I love the sound of the trumpet as a soloist. That's the bottom line. I love, you know, in recital with piano, and I love the sound of the trumpet with the orchestra as a soloist. I just think there's something so unique about it. But I also really, truly love to play in the back of the orchestra as first trumpet. And so I'm trying to do both. But I can tell you honestly, Jose, it's especially lately, maybe it's because I'm getting older. I had a daughter. I have now a 2-year-old daughter. It's really, really, really tough. And I can tell you this with all honesty, I still haven't figured out the best way to practice for both. I always feel like I'm never prepared enough. Okay. But maybe that's part of why it works. so far is because I always feel insecure about, hey, did I cover that passage? Is that, should I do that? You know, maybe half tempo. Should I save my chops in the orchestra tonight? Cause I have a solo. I mean, I'm always like thinking about a good equilibrium between the two. And I think that's why I actually have found maybe a way to protect myself, because I will share with you that, you know, I got in big trouble in my chops a long time ago, quite some time ago, by over-practicing, by just doing way too much. And since I've worked my way out of that, I'm now always contemplating on the best balance, the best way to, as Phil Smith used to say in our lessons, you know, strengthen your chops without abusing your chops.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, that's a really deep subject that I think sometimes, well, one, when we start playing, you know, when we're bit by that bug, when you know, you're in high school or you're in college and you're young and dumb, it's just pound, pound, pound. I mean, we see it in the trumpet world, but I mean, we also see it in other things. I mean, you see it in athletics, you see it in so many different things where your resiliency is at probably at its peak physically. So you can get away with doing stuff, even partying. You know, you can go out and you can drink all night long and get up and go to class the next day. Well, there comes a day where it takes you much longer to recover from whatever activity you've been, you know, enjoying. So, you know, I think as we get older, we have to become much more efficient in however we approach our practice or any of the activities that we deal with. So, you know, when you're trying to balance that, you know, what is your approach? I mean, how do you think about, you know, managing? Because I think that's one of the things that so many of us struggle with is, you know, how do you make the most of your practice and, you know, without killing yourself, but also, you know, making sure that you're pushing yourself enough to make the improvements that are necessary.
Yeah, sorry. Let me get into some specifics then. Let me tell you what I just did before this podcast. Right. I have my categories in my warm up and fundamentals. I have my categories that are non-negotiable. I hit them every day. And without telling you specific exercises, I will tell you, and I can justify that in a moment, but I'll tell you that every day I do some sort of long tone practice that morphs into vocalese practice. So long tones, obviously sustaining long notes in pretty much all registers, but mostly middle and low register and pedals. And then I do like vocalese, could be like Jim Stamp. So working through sustained tones, but moving them slowly through the horn. So middle register to low, middle to pedals, middle pedals to upper, middle pedals to extreme upper, starting upper, going all the way down to pedals. That's something I do every day. So long tones, vocalese, that turns into flexibility. So flexibility is a moving vocalese. So moving faster, like through violin, or I love Scott Belk's flexibility books, Charles Colin, any Schlossberg stuff. What else do I do? Trying to think of other flexibility books, and I'm blanking right now. Pick your favorite flexibility book. Find the one that the exercises that really work for you, that make you stronger and feel really gooey and connected through your playing, and work those through. After I do flexibility, I go to what I call scales three ways. So that's slur to legato tongue to staccato tongue. I always do those three variations. And then my last part of my fundamentals every day is what I call power. Now, the power for me is extending my dynamic spectrum. So flexibility within the dynamic. So being able to play right up to double F or triple F. I'm usually hanging around the double F area to get my extreme. Then swinging that all the way back down to pianissimo or even softer. And where I work the softer is to really get the taper on the note, you know, to feather out of notes. I really take a lot of care to work on feathering out of my notes so that that's the art of phrasing for me to be able to finish a note well. So that power section is really important to me because I think dynamic practice is a way to have another kind of flexibility in your playing. If you play monodynamically in your warm-up, and then all of a sudden you're asked to play extreme dynamics in a gig, you're not prepared. Not to mention artistically, let's just talk about the artistic merit. If you don't have an extreme dynamic register, you can't honor the composers in the way that they really wrote. I just worked through Mahler 2. There's passages there that are double F, triple F up on high Cs. And you have to be able to do that at that volume with your best sound and intonation. But you also, towards the end of the first movement of Mahler 2, there's double P, you know, little trumpet calls, C to high G, that you have to also manage that with your best sound and your best intonation. So that dynamic range is very, very important to me. Now, because I mentioned to you that I've got this Michael Fine trumpet concerto and Mahler 2 right now that I'm practicing at the same time, what I decided to do, and this is something that I do very often, is rather than just play the same old exercises for 30 minutes in my fundamentals, my long tone practice came out of long tone licks from Mahler 2 and the Michael Fine trumpet concerto. My flexibility work morphed into passages from Mahler 2 and Michael Fine. So I'll just give an example for those of you that know Mahler 2. Last movement, you have da 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 dim da dum da dum da dum da dum. You have them in various keys: B flat minor, B minor. So I started to do passages like that in my flexibility in all keys. Slur them, legato tongue them, staccato tongue them, play them soft, play them really loud. So while I'm warming myself up and doing all the keys so I'm comprehensive, I'm also practicing the Mahler 2. Then rather than do my typical scale work, I looked for scalic passages in the Michael Fine trumpet concerto, of which there are many, but they're really awkward. They're not what the ear gravitates towards, but that worked really well for me to include them in my warm-up. And I transpose them in all keys, like a jazz player would do. Slur, legato, staccato, extremely loud, extremely soft. So I was able to get my warm-up, but I was also able to practice passages from the Michael Fine concerto and the Mahler 2. Then I took a small break, and normally now after my warm-up, if I have a day off like I do today, I'll do etude practice. Well, I just don't have enough chops to do that and practice these new pieces, the new piece in the Mahler 2. So I took a 10-minute break, and then I decided to, the Michael Fine concerto is 7 pages long, and out of that, it's all written in one movement, like the Aratunian. And rather than run the whole concerto, because I'm just not strong enough to do that right now, I divided it up into 5 sections, like 5 etudes. And I just, in half tempo, because I can't play the licks up to tempo right now, I did basically, in my mind, 5 etudes, but it was the Michael Fine concerto that I played without stopping in 5 sections at half tempo. So I checked my list of what I would do anyway, but I put in place what I have to prepare. I hope that I explained that well.
Yeah. I mean, that's brilliant. That is absolutely brilliant. So, it's taking, because I think a lot of times people look at practice as being something that's separate from, the performance or the musical skills, you know, like right. Stuff. And, you know, when you're limited in time, taking what the things you got to work on and making that your practice, I think that's really brilliant. But I think even more important is like having that very clear concept of, you know, your non-negotiables, of being able to say, every day I need to do this. And I think sometimes we get married to the process of things. It's like, yes. You know, I have to play, you know, these stamp exercises, or I have to play this Caruso exercise, or I have to play this Schlossberg exercise. As opposed to, this is the idea that I'm trying to practice.
Yes.
Then let's find some way to do it that's creative.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And if I could just interject for a second, I want to backtrack to what I was saying about I'm not going to give my exercises in those concepts that I explain because they're rotating for me. If I just do major scale, let's say in my scale segment, if I just do major scales every day, well, how boring is that? I've been playing for, you know, since I'm 10 years old. I'm actually going to play major scales every day or minor scales every day. I mean, I'm the last 5 years I've been trying to improvise. So I warm up very often on blues scales or Lydian or Dorian or Mixolydian or whatever, you know, I mix it up all the time. So that process is, you're totally right, it's creative. And when we talk about fundamentals, what I'm hearing in a lot of younger students is that there's no concept to the fundamentals. They're just banging out exercises with no concept, no attention to the quality of the sound or the intonation, the clarity on the articulation, this connectivity and the slurs, or even phrasing. You can phrase your exercises. There's a peak point, there's a start point, there's a peak point, there's a taper point. And if you do that, it's again, you're being more efficient because, you know, certainly when we practice some exercises, certainly, let me be clear about this. It's got to sound archaic. It's got to sound like a caveman playing the horn. Sometimes, yes. If you heard some of the things I do, you would think this guy's a beginner. I mean, when I'm doing my glissando slurs or my reverse bending stuff or lead pipe practice, it doesn't sound good, but it gets my lips in the right position. But then the ultimate goal is to make your fundamentals sound impeccable, incredible. In all ranges, at all speeds, at all dynamics. And then you transfer that directly. There's a direct correlation from what you're doing in your technique to how you make music. Because in the end of the day, what we're actually doing is making music. And that's something else that I, you know, as I travel and do more teaching and masterclasses, I push hard. I know some people, maybe it's tough love for them, but I won't accept just having good technique. There's too many players that have really, really amazing technique. I grew up in an era, I sound like the old guy now, but I grew up in an era where, you know, there was Herseth and there was you know, Tom Stevens and there was Duck Schitzer and there was Winton and there was Hokan and there was, you know, all these, this huge variety of sound color and sound palette, and each one had their own personality in the way that they play. And I'm not hearing that as much in younger students these days. I'm hearing kind of a generic homogenous sound, which is wonderful. That's wonderful. And we all aspire to have that toolbox of great playing. But really at the end of the day, what we're after is to have a strong musical presence and to move people with your playing. Not just move trumpet players with your playing, but move audiences. When we talk about classical music surviving, it's got to touch the heart. It's got to touch the soul. It's got to move you from the inside out. And that's the reason I wanted to play in the first place, because I was moved when I was a kid. I wasn't sitting back there thinking, wow, that's perfect double tonguing. I want to have perfect double tonguing. I mean, of course, that's part of the process. And of course, I want that. But I want that perfect double tonguing with incredible music making. That's always been the goal. Sorry, I went off on a tangent, but you got me excited.
No, absolutely. That's great stuff. You know, because from the commercial side of things, you know, it's always the, you know, higher, faster, louder, or, you know, on the jazz side, you know, okay, well, you know, how fast can I play? How many bebop licks do I know? You know, that sort of thing. And it becomes like when you go to a conference, like, you know, something like ITG, and, you know, you've got, Yeah, you got the lead players that come in and they're testing out horns, and it's like, how loud and, you know, how many double C's can I play? You know, the jazz players is like, how fast can I, you know, play this bebop lick? Then the classical players, it's like, okay, well, how many people, you know, like how many versions of the Artunian or, you know, pictures of the exhibition do I have to listen to as people are trying out stuff? And so it becomes like these are their markers. You know, this is, I aspire to be able to do this thing. Yeah. As opposed to when you have a cat that comes up, you know, if they're trying out a horn or trying out a mouthpiece, and they're not trying to play the technical aspect. It's just they're trying to make music, and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, this guy I could listen to, you know, or this girl I could listen to for a while, because they're actually, you could hear that it wasn't about the technique; it was about, you know, creating some sort of emotional connection with the horn and then with the listener. So it's real interesting to me when I talk to people from different approaches to music, you know, the thing that really separates to me the great players from the rest of the players in the world is that understanding that, yes, this is about emotion, and the technique is just the way that allows us, it removes as many obstacles from us being able to express our idea and get the audience to be able to understand it and hear it. So, you know, technique is not driving the ship. Technique is just making it a little bit easier for us to do what we want to do.
That's exactly right. That's exactly it. And my teachers in Chicago Symphony that I had, because I played for growing up, I took lessons from Herseth, Will Scarlett, Chickowitz, and Clevenger. Those are four different players from Chicago Symphony that I had the privilege to take lessons from growing up as a teenager. And it was Clevenger and Herseth in lessons that would say to me, you've got to tell a story. You've got to put your statement on it. Put an exclamation point on what you're doing. You got to be more convincing. Come on. The music drives the technique, not the other way around. Lead by that. I remember playing Goldenberg and Schmoyle for Clevenger at his house. It was a 3-hour lesson. My chops were really tired. And I was playing it safe because I knew I couldn't get through it if I didn't back off. And he's like yelling at me. He was like, no, that's not how it goes. It's got to be, you know, like sputtering and hard and brilliant. And you're not playing that way. Come on, come on, come on. So I did it for like 2 bars, and I couldn't last any longer than 2 bars. He said, that's it. I said, well, Mr. Clevenger, can I ask you a question? If I do that, if I play like that, I can't last more than 2 measures. He said, well, what does that tell you? You got to practice more like that so you build your endurance. But playing like that, you know, so the point is, like, you have to know how it goes in your head to understand what you have to do in your technical practice. I mean, Mahler too, what I was just doing in my warm up, my long tones, they were going up to high C's because that last movement, you know, they have bom, 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 then you hit the high C, double forte for 3 bars down to pianissimo. And that's the power of God. That high C, what Mahler intended that to be, was biblical. It comes out of the Bible. It's the sound of the last trumpet before the end of the world, and then the resurrection starts. That's the second part of the fifth move in a Mahler II. When you think about that story, doesn't that tell you a whole different way to play that high C? Not playing it safe. I'm going to swing for the fences on that high C. Now, if I don't practice that in my practice room, I'm going to have to play it safe on stage. But to Clevenger's point, if you know how it goes, that means in the practice room, you have plenty of time to prepare that and have enough chops to do that. Listen to Phil Smith's recording with the New York Philharmonic and Leonard Bernstein of Mahler II, the fifth move, that high C. I was studying with him at the time, and I was at that performance with Bernstein in the audience, and he played it alone. It's written for 4 trumpets. He played it alone because I think there was intonation problems or something. I don't really know exactly why, but he chose to play it alone. Oh my God. If you didn't think you heard the power of God in a treble player, it's coming out Phil Smith's bell on that recording. Please, any student listening here, take a listen to that. And that's what I'm talking about. So there's a way to do it. And anybody can do that. Anybody can play that high C like you did, really. If you practice it the right way for enough years and enough time and efficiently, you can do it. But you have to have that in your ears in the practice room for many, many months before you dare to go on stage and play it like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like the idea that you have these different phases in your practice, and you know, much like Joey, I do like sports, and to draw a sports analogy, I mean, you have practice that you do that is you're doing your walkthroughs, and you are just kind of working out the bugs of things. But you have to have as close to real-time performance practice as well. You have to try and simulate the best that you can what you're going to be demanded to do. So I think sometimes it's too easy to lose sight of that, you know, like you're saying, if you've got to be able to play that high C at that volume and then taper it off, and it has to have the feeling of being the final trumpet sound, you have to practice it that way. You can't go up on stage and just expect it to come out of the horn. You have to put yourself in that situation. And I think that what you were saying about understanding the nature of what Mahler was trying to accomplish at that point, what he's trying to create, yeah, that creates a completely different feeling than even just looking at it on paper and saying, okay, yeah, it's got to be loud and it's got to taper, but the emotion behind it, you cannot go into that half-assing it, in any stretch of the imagination.
Well, let's take a look at Mahler 5, which I just recorded. It's the first time in my career that I've ever recorded a Mahler symphony, and it happens, it's the Mahler 5th. I mean, my God, that's the one, that's the one I've always dreamed of. That was the one I heard Herseth do when I was a kid. I mean, I posted something on Instagram about it, and I got a lot of comments about it. And because I wrote that this took me back to when I was growing up as a kid. I really felt that it was a full circle moment. Now let's think about what Mahler, why did he write that funeral march? Was it just, I feel like writing for a funeral march. I mean, no, it was a personal connection of him losing his own child. And eventually on the next symphony, the 6th, he knew that he had a fatal heart condition. He had been diagnosed with a heart condition before he wrote the 5th, but he didn't know he was going to die. But his child did die. And the symphony starts with a funeral march that is represented by the trumpet. You don't think when he wrote that came with a lot of emotion and a lot of something very deep from within him? And the way Mahler wrote was he wrote sadness on top of happiness layered together so that you could live both ways, because that was the reality of his life. When you process that and that emotion, it gives a whole different perspective of how to play that opening solo. And when I researched, I mean, I listened to every recording again. I've always done that, but before we recorded it, I went back and listened to everybody I could find out there. And and wanted to come up with an interpretation that I felt was representative of what Mahler wanted and what I was capable of doing and what I wanted to do as an artist with respect to what Mahler wanted. I mean, this is a huge responsibility that supersedes, it goes way beyond technique. But the interesting thing that I try to tell students is that if you have this in your mind, it actually makes the technique easier. That's the irony of the whole thing. Because if you just look at what Mahler wrote, that's pretty straightforward. It's just, four articulations. But if you only play it like four articulations, you're actually going to make it harder for yourself, because you're just worried about having four perfect articulations instead of understanding what this is. It's actually a drum roll. It's a drum roll. Rum, rum, and so that's a different way of thinking about how you should play that opening fanfare. Anyway, I could go on for this forever, but it's my point is that from my perspective, and again, I feel like the old guy here, but from my perspective, I don't want to compromise on the idea that, you know, we can't just show great technique. That's just not good enough. You got to be able to, like Charlier's book, The Transcendental Etudes, you have to transcend that technique. If you want to make a sports analogy, I also grew up with Michael Jordan. I played basketball in high school. I grew up in Chicago. I went to live games. I probably saw about 6 to 8 games, including playoff games with Michael Jordan. And when I watched Michael, I was very fortunate. When I had the job in Montreal, I had enough money finally to buy a courtside seat. So I bought a courtside seat next to the Bulls bench, game 7 against the Indiana Pacers. Then he went to Utah and he won his 6th and final ring. And I was sitting there. I was probably 15 feet from MJ. And the game was on the line. They were behind. And it wasn't just that he did win the game, obviously, and he won the game. It wasn't just that he made the shots. It was more than that. It was more than his technique. It was the way he did it, his focus, his energy, his commitment, the passion that he drove to the hoop. There was no way he was not going to make that shot. I mean, you knew, everybody in the stadium knew it, because of the commitment to what he was doing. And it was beautiful the way he would do it. It was an artistry to it, you know? Even when he slammed dunk, you know, tomahawk dunk over people, there was a beauty to it, you know? Because he practiced that. He practiced it. He dreamed of it. It was in his head before it was on the court.
Yeah, I mean, the mental, it's the combination of the mental aspect, the emotional aspect, and the physical aspect. When those come together, those are the transcendent personalities and the performances. And yeah, we need to get on that wheel at some point. You know, whether it's starting with the technical aspect or whether it's starting with the mental aspect, it doesn't matter. I don't think it matters where you start. But at some point, you have to be able to get all of them rolling together. And, yes, you know, and in terms of when you talk about technique, you know, I guess it's, sometimes it becomes a sterility because we become so focused on making a perfect performance. One of my martial arts teachers always used to say, you know, ugly practice, beautiful performance. You know, it's the, yes, you need to be able to get in and dig down and really refine the minutiae of your movement. But you have to also remember that you have to be able to let those things go if you to make it beautiful. So like when you're working with a student, I mean, how do you help them to understand or try to understand that it is about transcending the technique, that it is about something so much more than just, you know, how fast can you tongue and how fast your fingers are.
Well, let's talk about what you just said, because, you know, that part of like, I'll never forget, there was a bass trombonist I worked with in New Orleans Symphony, Dick Erb. And we were talking about this, and just in terms of practicing some things, like especially loud playing. Loud playing, at times when you're first learning to play loud, let's talk about on the classical side, it can be not such an easy process. And sometimes you sound not so great trying to get there because your red line is not very far out. You know, it's like past mezzo forte, you start, your one's tone might not be as great. And he said to me, yeah, Paul, you know, you got to grab the shitty end of the stick. You know, sometimes you got to grab the shitty end of the stick. He's talking about like a toilet plunger. I don't know what his reference was, but that phrase always stuck in my head. Like sometimes you've got to go through the crap. Sorry to be so brutal here, but you know, you got to go through that, what I called it before, that caveman or cavewoman approach, archaic approach, just to get the lips in shape to do what we want to do. And then you polish the stone, you polish, 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 until that loud playing sounds incredible. And it sounds effortless. So to your point, what I tell my students is understand, number one, how you want to sound at the end of that. What's your goal? How do you want to sound on that? If you can't describe it for me, is there a recording of a player that you like that does it? Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that player. Let me hear it. You know, like I talked about that high C of Phil Smith. I mean, I was there at the performance. So, I mean, when I play it next week, that sound is still ringing in my head from how many years ago that was. And that's the sound that I used when I was a student to model my own playing. The process to get there was not fun. Sometimes I'd fall off the high C to get that sound. Or, you know, let's say between 1 and 10, 10 being the loudest volume when, you know, when I was a student, I could only get to about a 6 or a 5. But then that 6 turn, that 5 turns into a 6, the 6 turns into a 7, 7 turns into an 8. Eventually, you will eventually get there. So if you're patient and you're clever, like clever meaning that you know the process will work for you eventually, and you have to be patient to get there, you will get it. You will get it. There's technically, you know, I may stir some controversy here by saying this, but in my humble opinion, you should be able to do pretty much what one person can do, another person can do. I mean, if it's been proven that you could, with enough practice, you should be able to do most things, you know? A guy like Winton, he does absolutely insane things with his technique, but I mean, it's not just because he's freakishly talented, which he is, but he works his butt off at it, and he works so hard at it. Maybe the way he processes, the way he works, is much quicker than other people. He's a very, 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 very intelligent and creative person, the way he works on things. So you need to ask yourself, are you working on that intelligently? But I do believe that you can work. I'm a case in point. I mean, when I was younger, I had my weaknesses going into Eastman were loud, high playing, soft articulate playing, piccolo playing, most of the stuff in the upper register, and endurance. And now I've been playing first trumpet, where it highlights all those things. And those things for me are not, I don't worry about that so much anymore. But I worked really, really, really hard to get those attributes in my playing. So I think to a student, you just have to tell them, listen, you can do it. You can definitely do this. Now we need to make a plan. How are we going to do this? Here's what I think you should be doing. Let's try this. See you next week. If it's a little bit better, thumbs up. If it's the same, we need to adjust the plan a bit. If it's worse, we need to consider maybe there's overpracticing been going on. So we need to taper back a little bit, find our sweet spot. Oh, there's the sweet. That's the number of hours in a day you should practice. Those are the sessions you should do. Here are the specific exercises I think you should do for this amount of time. 7 minutes on loud, long tones that you know, taper to pianissimo. In my case, it was 10 this morning. It was 10 minutes. Seriously, sometimes I set the timer. I'm like, 10 minutes, I'll do this, you know, and then 7 minutes, I'll do this flexibility, and then 8 minutes, I'll do this interval practice, you know, whatever it is. I mean, because I have to be time efficient, especially when you have a daughter. I don't know if you have kids, but you know, when I have my daughter like upstairs saying, Papa, Papa, and it's time to go to daycare, I mean, I got to wrap it up. I got to wrap up my warm up, get her to daycare, come back, and then start part two of my session, which I explained to you earlier.
Well, that's such a, it is a thoughtful and somewhat scientific approach to practice. It's the practicality of it. But then there's the artistic side, which is much like playing, the flexibility to be able to adjust how you approach those things. And it seems like there's always, at the end of the day, there's always the, yeah, but this is so I can make music. It's not the practicing the technique to make the technique better. It's practicing the technique to make the technique better so the music can come out.
That's correct. That's correct. And for students, what's really important for me to try to communicate to them is to understand, you know, hey, what's your interpretation here? How do you want to sound? Let's dream. Let's dream big. What's your ideal of how you want to sound on this? And let's take the baby steps to get there. You know, I believe in deconstructing things. You know, we see something like the Tomasi Concerto visually and we get really intimidated. But if you simplify, The baby steps will get you there. And a player that normally maybe thinks that they can't play that piece, with thoughtful practice and time, because it does take time, you can do it. You can do it. Unless, there's so many stories of people that have done incredible things. A blind guy climbing Everest, you know, people with prosthetic legs running a marathon. There's, you know, I can go on and on and on and on and on. There's so many incredible stories of the human spirit. Can't play the Tomasi? If you're a decent trumpet player, but you're hung up by technical issues, that's exactly the problem. You're hung up on technical issues. We need to make a plan to understand how to work through those technical issues so that you can sound the way you're dreaming. So how do you want to sound on this? I remember growing up here in Chicago Symphony Live, and I would go into the practice room and imitate those sounds, that just try to make that sound. And maybe you can make it on one note, or maybe three notes, maybe 10 notes. Eventually it'll be 20 and then 50 and 100 and da 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 da. It goes. But you have to imitate those sounds. You have to know how you want to sound.
Yeah. Well, I'm a firm believer, like you were saying earlier, that if it has been done, that means it can be done. You know, if one person has done it, okay, maybe that's a fluke. Okay, I'll give you that. But if more than one person has been able to accomplish something, then that means that it can be accomplished. Now, the question is for you, you know, or for the individual, is, do you have a plan? And, you know, you have to have a plan. And granted, some people, I hate to use the word natural, but there's a great book, Talent is Overrated, and it's talking about like the studies of Professor Erickson, the studies of success and mastery, you know, these kind of concepts, there are people that are predispositioned for certain things. They may have a specific physical structure that lends it towards being able to do something with less effort than someone else, that has to overcome something or has to develop those particular skills or those experiences. So I certainly believe that there are people that are set up, but anybody can do it. But you just have to be able to do. You have to have the game plan. You have to have the patience. You have to have the guidance, and it's understanding that there is inevitably a trade-off for everything. There's a price that you have to pay for everything, and I think that the reason a lot of people don't have success is that either A, they don't have the game plan or the guidance that they need to get there, but they're not willing to do to pay the price, which may be sacrificing one aspect of their life in order to be able to accomplish that specific goal. You have to be able to be able to put the time in. It seems to me that you are, besides being a gifted player, that you are a very passionate educator. So as an educator, what are the tools that you pull out to inspire students and to understand, help them to understand that, yes, there is going to be, there's a path that you're going to need to follow. There's a process you're going to need to follow. How do you help to encourage them through those inevitable shitty end of the stick moments?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a passionate educator because my teachers, really all of them, I've been very, very lucky. My teachers were more than teachers to me. They were mentors. They were like father figures to me. And they were amazing. And now they're friends, you know, and it's, you know, my teachers have meant the world to me. And that, I should say, that was Jerry Loyett when I first started, Ray Sasaki, Herseth, Charlie Geyer, Phil Smith, Barbara Butler. These individuals, they gave me so much, not only information of how to play the trumpet, but ways to work, ways to honor the work, honor your work, be disciplined, be, you know, that's for me, it was never an issue of hard work. I am, you know, I don't think I'm that talented on the trumpet. I don't think I'm that gifted on the trumpet. I'll just be 100% real with you. Like, I'm not, I'm just not. I should have continued with basketball, but you know, that probably wouldn't have worked very well. but I'm not gifted on the trumpet. I'm a really, really, really stubborn, hard worker. I love the work and I love a challenge. And where I'm probably gifted is I'm a great problem solver. I love chess. I love to think moves ahead. And I love a challenge. I love, you know, if something can't be done or if somebody were to tell me you can't do that, oh my God, that gets me so excited, you know. Really? Who are you to say that I can't do that? You know, that gets me, like, that's my competitive, that's my sports competitive side. And then I'll work even harder because I love proving people wrong. I love that. But more, it's more to prove to myself that I can actually do it. So with a student, I need to know from the get-go, if they're going to enter, you know, like with me at McGill, or if they're going to come to Santa Barbara where I teach at Music Canada in the West, or if I'm working with students on a, you know, some, a lot, I have a lot of like Zoom students that come see me every once in a while, they'll do 2, 3, 4 lessons in a row. I need to know their level of motivation. I need to know their level of work. Discipline is the art of work. Discipline is understanding that you can't just work mindlessly like I did when I was a kid. What did you say? Like young, dumb, and stupid. What, young and dumb? I mean, I can't just do that. That gets me in trouble. That's when my chops are so inflamed that I can't even play a note anymore. That's just dumb. That's not hard work. That's dumb work. So the discipline is the art of work, which is knowing that, okay, 10 minutes is enough to do those long tones on a high C or around that range. That's just like barely too much. And then I have to move on to something else. And then tomorrow's another day and I'll do a little bit more. And I'll go a little higher tomorrow. That's discipline. And then, okay, 45 minutes is probably about my max in terms of where I work at my best in one session, 45 minutes. That's a sweet spot for me. I'll put that to an hour sometimes, but around 45, 50 minutes is fine. That's discipline. Then understanding that I can't bite off the whole Michael Fine concerto right now. I've got to slowly go through in sections, probably for the next month. That's discipline. So, you know, where I like to live is discipline. I love discipline and I love hard work. That's my talent. And I think students, if I understand their level of motivation and if we can make a plan so that they're disciplined, anything is possible. But if they're not willing to work extremely hard and extremely smart, we're going to have an uphill climb. And the other thing is that I never give up. I never, ever give up. When I want something, I'm going to go at it till I get it. I don't care if it takes my whole life. I may still never get it, but I'm never, ever going to give up on it. And that's something where students, they give up too easily. They see day after day or month after month or even year after year, something's not working, they give up. That's just where it gets super interesting. Now, I understand people have to make a living. I understand that. So I have to find a way to do both. I have to find a way to make a living and still, you know, it's extremely tough. You know, it's extremely, extremely tough. But I have students that have done this, taken part-time jobs, done whatever they can do, worked through their issues, and then boom, all of a sudden they win an audition. And you just never know how things are going to work out. You never, ever, ever know. It's not the algorithm that we predict for ourselves when we're kids. You just have to have that discipline. You have to never give up, and you have to make a plan on how you're going to get there. Work from the successful side. Work from your dream. What is that dream? Work backwards from there. And it could be a very, 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 very long road, and that road may take you in many, many different directions. But it's the person that never gives up that will eventually find their way. And even if they don't, they might get super close, or it might take them to someplace that they never expected that's much better than the dream.
Yeah. Well, it's being engaged in the process as opposed to the result.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when we say we are successful when we have this singular result, that's where we start to lose sight of the process. And, you know, for me, it is less important that, I mean, certainly I'm a firm believer in goal setting and things like that and having a plan and, you know, all that good stuff. But it's like, if I never achieve the ultimate objective, you know, the having this one accomplishment, but I'm constantly going through the process. I'm in love with the grind, and I love that. You know, that to me, that is a success. The success is if I'm working and if I'm moving, then okay, that I'm successful. You know, if I never achieve that one accolade or that one accomplishment, it doesn't really matter because every day I'm just working and I'm making progress. So yeah, I definitely feel you on that. That's absolutely kind of where I live as well. And I mean, that the idea of discipline, I think sometimes we lose sight that discipline isn't a bad thing. You know, it's not a negative thing. It's being able to understand the boundaries, and you can't make the progress, like the concept of flow, that, you know, we reach flow when we're at that spot where we're just kind of at the boundaries of what we're capable of doing at any given point in time. We're fully engaged in that process, but having discipline is what allows us to get to that spot where we're just at the edge and not too far out. Because if we go too far beyond our abilities, and that's when we have major frustration and breakdowns, physical breakdown, mental breakdown, emotional breakdowns, whatever, because we've pushed ourselves too far outside of that zone. So yeah, I mean, I really love the concepts that you're talking about, and I can't wait to start to apply some of them to my own practice. So I'm going to steal some of those ideas. And I've been doing some of those recently myself, of, you know, having like little problem licks for things and like trying to figure out how can I take this and make this part of my maintenance routine that I do every day, so that even if I don't get 2 hours to work on this, you know, this chart, you know, on a given day, I know I'm addressing some of the issues that are pertinent to me being able to actually perform that. So I definitely enjoy that concept. That's great.
Well, what's fun too about that, I'll say one more thing about that. What's fun too about that is that, again, like a muscle in the body, you know, if you go weightlifting and you always are doing the same exercises, your muscles doesn't grow anymore because you're doing the same weight, the amount of weight, the same exercise. You're not burning the muscle anymore. The muscle has gained strength and you're not challenging it anymore. So, you know, the exercises that we do, that's why I'm very hesitant to, what I've had so many students ask me, Paul, can you give me your warm-up? Write down your, can I write, you know, you have it on a sheet or what? Well, I can give you what I did like last month. It's all based on the same conceptual fundamentals that I just explained to you earlier. But this month, it's these exercises. And they're custom tailor-made to what I need in my work right now. I'm not going to give a student those licks from the Michael Fine Concerto. They would look at me like I'm crazy in all keys. You know, so, but I mean, maybe I would, certain students I would. But my point is, like, it's fun for me when I have a new concerto like that and I'm looking at these passages like, oh my God, this is nuts. But then I make that part of my routine. Eventually those licks become very playable, very, very, very playable. I'm not there yet. But, you know, hopefully in Guanajuato, Mexico, with the Guanajuato Symphony Orchestra on November 25th, I will be there. It better be there. I'm in big trouble.
Yeah, well, but, you know, one of the things that you know, is interesting to me, and, you know, whether you're talking about, like, you know, for you, or you're looking at MJ, or, you know, anybody, it's, you know, people that are professionals that are, you know, at a very high level of skill. The average person, they see or hear the performance, but they don't get to see or hear the practice. And, you know, it, you're doing the ugly practice. You're hacking away at stuff. And you know, when you're talking about, okay, well, I'm going to have to do this, and I'm going to have to do this at half speed, and I can't play the whole thing. It's so rare to hear someone in your position talk like that openly, because
I probably should not do that.
but that's how you get to that spot. I mean, you know, and if you are passionate, you know, the collective you or the collective we, you know, if we're passionate about seeing our art form improve, then it's critical that people understand that, yes, there is that ugly practice that goes on. And it's okay for you to take things to half speed or quarter speed or whatever you got to do, or to just practice this one passage for the next 6 months, but just doing it with a methodical approach and with this game plan of every day, I'm just laying another brick in building this structure that's going to be this performance. And, yes. You know, I really appreciate that, because, I could have been a much better player if I had that understanding when I was younger. And I mean, and I still hate for people to hear me practice, because I sound like crap when I practice. But you know, it's like being willing to take the ego out of it. The practice is to get better, and to get better means that you got to do stuff that you can't do right now.
Yeah, that's it. Well, the ego has a big part to play in it, doesn't it? Because I think the ego is, you know, people are afraid. It's changing now, though, in the younger generation. I have to say, I'm very optimistic, because I'm hearing, well, Santa Barbara just was teaching a music academy, and the four students that I had, if they're listening here, you know, I'm not trying to pump up your own egos too much here, but they were such great players, but they were also really nice people and just really a pleasure to work with. And you know, I think back in the day, it was thought that, well, in order to be good, I have to just be this, you know, egomaniac and whatever, and kind of people were trashing other people and all that. And I think that's going away now. I'm so happy. I'm so happy about that. I think maybe the internet has something to do with that, because we can hear everybody now. We know how many great players there are out in the world. There's so many great players, so many great players. You know, it's just inspiring. You should use that as a tool to not to, you know, just take a piece of humble pie, but just to look at, like, wow, this guy's doing that, or she's doing that, or he's doing that, and I need to work on that. And you know, the whole point is, when you're humble to the process, you get better. Now, where the ego and the confidence should take center stage, no pun intended, is on center stage. When it's time to go out there, you should tell yourself, I know exactly how I want to play this. I know exactly how this should go. This is going to be the definitive interpretation of this at this point, at this time. I'm not trying to say that I'm better. I'm just saying that I know exactly how I want this to go. There's no question in my mind how this is going to go. And here it is. Boom. Now, if I fail miserably, I did my absolute best. I did all the process. I was convinced before I went on stage that I had that. Still, things may go amiss, may go awry. I'll give my example of my ITG recital in San Antonio. I'm very, very happy with it. However, it was so bloody hot in San Antonio. I think it was like 110 Fahrenheit. And coming from Canada, I just wasn't ready for that heat. It was overwhelming to me. Like, I would walk from the hotel to the church where I did my recital, and I would overheat. It would take me like 5 minutes just to wipe myself down. So in the recital, even though the church was air conditioned, but not, it wasn't really, really air, like greatly air conditioned. It was air conditioned sort of. I was sweating during the recital because I was nervous. I was just sweating. And I had to take a towel and just wipe myself off after every lick. And so I missed a couple notes in that recital that I don't think I would have normally missed as a result of just that. But I can totally live with that, because I had no control. There was no way for me to really know that it was going to be that uncomfortable for me, you know? And so, but I mean, overall, I'm very pleased with the recital. I think you could still listen to it on the ITG website, you know, if people want to hear what I see, what I went through, you know, but I mean, those are things that you just, you know, you do your best in that moment, but there wasn't a doubt in my mind before I went on stage that I knew exactly how I wanted to sound. So in that moment, at that time, you have to be convinced that you've done the work, you've visualized everything, you know how musically you want to go. Technically, you've done all the work, endurance-wise, chop-wise, you have all the strength, all the flexibility. And then it's time, as you said, Jose, this is brilliant what you said, it's time to let go. You have to let go and you have to trust the work process. You have to trust that the work was done the right way. And that's all on you. That's not on your teacher, that's on you. And so that's the confidence, and maybe that's a bit of ego that you must have before you, right before you step on that stage. And that comes from the work process, which is a humble process. The work process is the humble process.
Yeah, I love it. I love it, man. God, we could go on these topics for like ages. But I do have 3 segments we need to get through before we can end our time today. So let's kind of hop on to and actually this first one maybe is a good one to start out with. And this is a segment called Sound Off. And Sound Off is brought to us by my good friend Michael Barkley of Barkley Microphones. It's about approach to sound. Now, when you're talking about your, as a principal player and as a soloist, you know, you have to be able to create this sound that not only matches the genre of music and the composition, but also expresses the feeling that you want to get out. So when you're working either with yourself or you're working with your students on developing the correct sound for a particular piece, what are some of the processes that you go through to remove as many obstacles as possible to develop that kind of perfect trumpet sound?
Clarity of sound is really important to me. So even though I may, you know, again, go through as you describe it, the ugly process, you know, just like, let's talk about those extreme louds in the Mahler. The clarity, even when I'm playing really, really loud, I want to have clarity and purity in my tone. I don't want a lot of garbage in the sound or something I don't want the sound to be spready, you know, and diffused. I want the sound to be concentrated and resonant at all times. And that goes for whether I'm playing Mahler or whether I'm playing, you know, Tomasi concerto. I want then in the Tomasi that those articulations in the outer movements are really pristine and that they're full of sound, that there's 3 parts to the note, the beginning, the middle, and the end. It's not just the beginning, which is percussive, and it's not just the middle, which is what I would call a wah-wah approach. It's the 3 parts, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And the end of the note is the beginning of the next note. So sound for me has to have clarity. It has to have 3 parts to the note, and it cannot be diffused. It has to be centered and concentrated.
Hey, cool. All right, let's move on to our next segment, which is called Geared Up. And Geared Up is brought to us by Venture Mouthpieces, Venture, where technology, design, and craftsmanship intersect. Use the code TRUMPETGURUS21, get 10% off your order. So this is about gear. As I promised you, we would talk about what size mouthpiece you play. but mostly the way I like to approach this is like when you're thinking about gear, and especially, you know, someone who's working with budding professional students, at some point you're going to need to rethink your gear. When you're guiding someone through that process, what is your mental approach or what is your strategy for picking the right kind of equipment to get the sound and get the expression that you're looking to get out of your instruments?
Well, the way I teach always is I'm balancing the strengths and weaknesses of the individual that comes to me. I don't have a blanket approach that I have one approach for everybody. I don't really feel that works. And that wasn't the way my teachers taught me. So if somebody's coming in, they may have a great low register, but their high register is just not happening. And there's going to be issues there with, in terms of the balance that they're playing is all uneven, or vice versa. Their highs are are really good, but they have no low register. You know, we need to work on this. So if it comes down to an equipment choice, which I always feel that you need to work, whatever you're playing, you need to work first on the technical issue to the best of your ability. Then once I feel like we've got some gains in that, now let's consider an equipment change as a possibility here. So let's just say that it was the player that was a little more open and had a great lower register, but maybe had a lot of difficulties in the upper register. You know, we might take a look and say, well, that mouthpiece you're playing is just too big, or the throat or the backboard is just too big for you. It's not creating enough resistance to help you get up in that register where you can float and it's singing and easy. And then on the contrary, maybe the player that's really got great highs but doesn't have much sound in low register, well, maybe that's too small of an equipment, or a rim is too thin, or the throat could be opened up. Let's talk about that. Let's see how that might complement the work we're doing to get you down there to make it easier for you. And these are baby steps. I don't think you can just find that equipment right away. I think it's going to be a process. And it's a hard process. Changing mouthpieces is a difficult process. I mean, I can't lie. When I've done it, it's usually like the first couple of days, it feels great to me. Then like after the first week, it feels terrible. Then after 2 weeks, all of a sudden it's like, oh, there it is. Okay, fine. I can work with that. You know, so it is a gestation period that you have to go through. And I think that's the guidance that a teacher can really help you with.
Okay, cool. I like it. All right, final segment. This is in many ways my favorite one because it's crazy. This is our Robinson's Remedy Rapid Fire Round, brought to us by Robinson's Remedy, rapid relief for your sore and tired chops. This is a series of questions that just kind of bounce all over the place. There's no rhyme or reason. So I just want to get your quickest response to this series of questions. Are you ready, Paul?
I'm nervous. Okay, let's go.
All right, let's do it. All right, first question. Who's the biggest influence on your life that's not a trumpet player?
Michael Jordan.
What's your favorite book?
The Talent Code.
What's the worst movie you've ever seen?
Oh, my God. Oh, that's a tough one. Oh, my God. I was going to say Dumb and Dumber, but I actually love that movie. Oh, man. Any horror movie. I don't like horror movies.
Okay. If you weren't a trumpet player, what would you want to be?
Either a tennis player or a basketball player.
All right. What's your favorite drink?
Really good red wine.
Okay. Speaking of wine, you're going to have a dinner party. And you could invite any three living people. Let's exclude, you know, people that you would normally spend time with, like your wife and people like that. But you could have any three people in the world come to this dinner party, spend an evening with you. Who would you want to have there?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. That's a great question. That's a great question. Wynton Marsalis, Rafael Nadal, and Barack Obama.
Okay, that sounds like a great evening. You've got three additional chairs at your dinner table, and you can invite any three people from history.
Gustav Mahler, Leonard Bernstein, and Timofey Dushkin.
Okay. Lacquer, plated, or raw?
Plated.
Okay. What's your favorite quote?
Well, there's a quote, there's a poem by Mother Teresa called The Final Analysis. And I'll let whomever's listening here, you can Google the entire poem for yourself. But the last line is basically, "For you see, in the end, it was never between you and them anyway, it's between you and you, or you and God, or you and whatever, but basically it's between you and you."
Okay, I like that one. What is your greatest fear?
Jumping out of a plane.
All right. You could be granted one superpower. What would it be?
Oof. Wow. Wow. That's a really good one. I'd like to be able to fly.
What aspect of trumpet playing do you feel is the most overrated?
Acrobatic without sound or phrasing.
All right. And what aspect do you think is the most underrated?
The ability to make an incredibly beautiful phrase.
All right. You are able to go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice about music. What would it be?
Don't overpractice.
And while you're back there, you're going to give your younger self one piece of advice about life.
Don't ever give up.
All right. And final question for you, Paul. What do you want your legacy to be?
That I serve music. Mm-hmm.
Well, you aced your test, sir.
Is there a score? Is there a score to it?
I have to get the scoreboard for that one, I think. So, that's actually great. Man, this has been really fantastic. I really have enjoyed talking with you and getting to know you. And I certainly look forward to getting to know you a little bit better as time goes on. And I certainly enjoyed a lot of the stuff that you had to say was so thought provoking. And I really felt that this was one of those hangs that really epitomizes what I'm trying to accomplish with this podcast.
Well, I really appreciated it, Jose. You do a great job, and it's like I found myself, talking about things in a way that it's very, very personal, very personal. But your questions are really great and right to the point. And I think a lot of what especially students need to hear right now. So thank you for doing this. It's great for the trumpet community to have you doing these.
No, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. And I look forward to hearing more from you and hearing about how your big concert turns out. And
you know what I should do? I should post some of my half tempo scale Michael Fine concerto scale stuff on Instagram. Maybe I'll do that.
I think that would be amazing. And you can check out links in the show notes. So if you want to follow Paul and what he's got going on, please do that. And follow him on social media. There's some great stuff on there. And thanks for spending time with us in this episode of The Hang. Remember to like, subscribe, share. If there's a golden nugget in here, make sure you pass it on to your friends, your colleagues. And if you have a suggestion for a future episode, hit me up. So as always, folks, peace and slide grease. We out.
Thanks for hanging with us today. This podcast is all about creating deeper connections through our mutual love of music and the trumpet life. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast and also like and share this episode with a friend. We want to see The Hang grow for show. Please support our sponsors and consider becoming a personal supporter of this podcast as well. Remember, for less than the price of a bottle of valve oil a month, you can keep this podcast moving smoothly. The Trumpet Guru's Hang is recorded at the Candy Factory, a co-working space and social club located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Jose Johnson is the executive producer. Post-production editing is by Mitch Bowers. Our opening theme song was composed and performed by Lexi Signor, and our closing theme music comes courtesy of The Greatest Funeral Ever. Incidental music is by Ethan Swayze and Jose Johnson. Graphic design by Ann Kirby of The Sweet Corps. The Trumpet Guru's Hang podcast is produced in collaboration with the So Good Lancaster Media Group.